I'm going to talk today on Thomas Sumter. Thomas Sumter is a really interesting person. A lot of his life parallels that of George Washington. He was born in 1734. He's 2 years younger than George Washington. And like George Washington, he's tall, he's 6 feet tall. Like George Washington, he served in the Colonial Army as a sergeant. Like George Washington, he was athletic and adventuresome and went into a couple of really interesting trips into the backcountry. Like George Washington, he became a general in the American Revolution. And like George Washington, he married a very wealthy woman. Like George Washington, Thomas Sumter is also from Virginia, even though you will see later his deep association with South Carolina. Early in Sumter's career, he volunteers for a mission up in Virginia. He was born in Perryville, Virginia, which is about 12 miles northwest of Charlottesville, Virginia. So he's out in the mountains. And he borrows 60 pounds from a fellow named Alexander McDonald. And he uses this money to help finance this trip that he's volunteered for to go into the backcountry from Williamsburg, Virginia, to treat with the Indians and solidify a peace treaty. Even though he's not in charge, and this is known as the Henry Timberlake Exhibition, he basically is financing this and staying in charge. So he goes to the backcountry on this mission, which turned out to be quite elaborate. They're so successful that they come back with three Indian chiefs that want to go across the Great Plains and meet the Great White Father. Portraits of two of those Indian chiefs in this book, that's the Gilcrease Museum in Tulsa, Oklahoma. This museum was started by a person named Thomas Gilcrease that lived in Tulsa. He was a very wealthy oil man on the leading edge of the great oil field discoveries in the early 1900s and became a multimillionaire. And he had a passion for collecting Indian art and artifacts. And he kept buying out and adding to his collection to the point where he had over 10,000 items. And it was the largest collection of its type in the world. And a little bit later, he goes bust. He declares bankrupt. He approaches the city of Tulsa because he owes them $35 million. And for forgiveness, I will donate my collection to you if you will maintain it. And he did. And this collection is amazing to me because these two portraits that you were shown, they've got to be priceless. If you look closely, can you open that up again and walk around close to the table? If you look at these photographs, these portraits, these are called Kit Kats. And Kit Kat is, as I understand it, is a three-quarter length portrait. Look closely at what they're wearing. Three-quarter length portrait with the hand short. And the one on the left, the one on the left is Cunning Choate, and you'll see that Choate is wearing two medals around his neck. One of those medals has a double image in its relief. One of those images is King George, and the second one is his wife. You might remember who King George III's wife was? Charlotte, as in Charlotte, North Carolina. The second medal that he's wearing says everything English. And if you look still closer, you'll see that he's also wearing a gorget. And on the gorget, which is a brass plate that officers typically would wear in the English Army, has G, Roman numeral 3, and R for King George III reigns. These were presented to the Indian chief by no other than King George III. The second one, the portrait on the right, is Ashenego. And he sort of appears as the leader of this group. Before they leave on this mission, they're going to sail over to England. And they're back in Williamsburg. The governor has gotten permission to fund this trip. And Ashenego here gives this impassioned speech at the edge of the campus of William & Mary. And one of the students that hears this speech is none other than a young student there by the name of Thomas Jefferson. Lots of history connected to the whole story of Thomas Sumter. They sail on that ship. They're accompanied by a translator that unfortunately dies in transit. So when they get to London, they don't have anyone in their party that can translate. And this apparently falls on Sumter to do his best. And he's busy learning some of the language. He's not an accomplished translator. They're met in London by a person that will become their benefactor named Lord Egremont. He is the Secretary of State. And he arranges for this group to tour such places as Kensington Gardens, Westminster Abbey, Tower of London, St. Paul's Cathedral, and a private audience for an hour and a half with King George III. A remarkable accomplishment. If you've been to London, some of these names will ring a bell. But let me read you the description of what these people look like as they're viewed for the first time by someone in England. The Secretary of State is speaking, quote, "Full, well-made men, they're near 6 feet tall, dressed in their own country fashion, with only a shirt, trousers, and a mantle around them. Their faces painted copper. Their heads adorned with shells, feathers, earrings, and other ornaments." And he arranges for these portraits to be painted. Those things have got to be priceless because they were painted in 1762 in London. These portraits were required 3 90-minute sessions to sit and be painted by famous portrait painters at the time. After a couple months, Ashenego apparently has a little bit too much firewater, and he gets in a hassle with a British officer who draws his sword, and the sword is taken from the officer and broken in two and given back to the officer by running into the chair. So Lord Egremont decides it's probably time for these folks to go home. So he arranges for passage that the ship is, instead of sailing back to Norfolk, and the ship is out for Charleston, South Carolina. Our hero at this point, Thomas Sumter, balks at this, and Lord Egremont says, "I will give you £50 now to help you, and when you arrive in Charleston, there'll be another £100 there to help you." Remember, he started out by borrowing £60. So Sumter agrees. They sail back, going to Charleston. He applies for his £100. The folks there say, "Hey, we weren't a part of that deal. We don't have any pay any money for you." But they did furnish some wagons and some horses for the return of the Indian chiefs back to the area where they came from, which was around modern-day Knoxville, Tennessee. So they head straight north from Charleston. And they stop and visit Indian villages along the way. Sumter, very athletic, he plays games with the Indians and usually wins whatever he plays. And along the way, he runs into one tribe as a Canadian, French-Canadian person there that's trying to learn the local language. And this French Canadian is telling these Indians in South Carolina that the British are losing the war and the French are winning, so they ought to change sides. Well, Sumter realizes how dangerous this is. He tells the Indian chief, "I'm going to arrest this guy." And the Indian chief says, You're on your own. We won't interfere, but you're on your own. So Sumter engages the guy in the fight, subdues him, ties him on a horse, takes him back into Charleston, and at this point turns him over to the authorities. The authorities realize the importance of this. They put this guy on a ship and they're going to send him back to London. But while Sumter's there, he's interviewed by the newspaper. And the newspaper writes this incredible story about this hero and what he's done. He's been over in London, he came back, and now he ran across this traitor, turned him over to authorities, and the story is going to make its way back to London and to Lord Egmont. So Sumter makes his way then, after this, back to his home, and who does he run into? Well, Alexander McDonald is waiting for his repayment. Sumter doesn't have a dime. He's hailed as a hero locally, but he's put in jail because of this debt. The jail's over in Staunton, Virginia. And it so happened that one of Sumter's friends was traveling through the countryside. And since in view of the time frame, there's no Motel 6 around. So he asks and gets permission to spend the night in jail. The next morning, he wakes up and Sumter's gone and left a note. He says, well, I'll borrow 10 shillings from you, and your tomahawk, and I'll repay you the first time I see you. Well, it will be 30 years before we see you again. But Sumter used this money to bribe the jailer, leaves not only the jail, not only Virginia, he goes back down to Charleston. And by this time, all this news about what Thomas Sumter had accomplished has made its way to London. And Lord Egmont sends him 700 pounds as a gift. And 700 pounds at that time were a fortune. So here's our friend making a huge splash on the scene in South Carolina. He takes his 700 pounds, goes up to what's referred to as the high hills of the Santee. This is up above Santee. It's a little bit southeast of modern-day Columbia. It's where the rivers fork. And he sets up a trading post and becomes a merchant. About this time, a very wealthy planter there by the name of Jameson passes away and leaves his wife, his plantation. So he's pretty well off. After about a year, Sumter starts to romance this lady. Her name is Mary Jameson. And in a short while, he marries her. She is 11 years older than Thomas, and she's 44 years old when they marry. Sumter is 33. About a year later, at age 45, she has a son, and they name that son Thomas. Thomas will have several children. Mary, as a young girl, she had polio, and she had a wilted left side of her body, her leg, her arms, so her mobility is somewhat limited. But they're very happy as a couple. Obviously, with a head start like that, Sumter is doing well financially. And also, as the winds of war start swirling around, he becomes a member of the 2nd Regiment of Militia that was involved in that battle that I talked about last time when I was talking about the first battle of Charleston or the battle of Sullivan. He's a lieutenant in that 2nd Regiment. Serves with distinction. A little bit later, that happened in 1776, 1778. That regiment is assigned as part of the expedition force from South Carolina that broke down and becomes part of Lackland McIntosh's troops, headed down to seal off the southern part of Georgia, the Florida line. And if you remember part of history, that was a disastrous mission. Primarily the troops were from South Carolina, but they were following it under the leadership of
Macintosh. Same time, Georgia had their own leader named Button Gwinnett. And between the two of them, they hassle all the time about who was in charge. Malaria set in, desertion set in. Something wound up with his troops. He was in the rear guard. His troops supposedly marched up and down the state of Georgia, 1,000 miles without ever firing a round. So he gets disgusted with the chain of command. Goes back home, brings his unit back, and resigns from the army. Goes back to his home. He's there May the 12th, 1780, when General Benjamin Lincoln surrenders all the troops at Charleston. And on that day, there are no armed troops in South Carolina. And the Patriots are zero. Out of those ashes, we will see that Andrew Pickens will arise, Francis Marion will arise, and Thomas Sumter will arise and lead their own leaders. Sumter, by this time, the state leadership, the governor, the civilian authorities have moved up into North Carolina where it's safe. And Governor Randolph appoints Sumter as a Brigadier General. He's the highest ranking militia officer in South Carolina. And Pickens and Francis Marion will be supported. They each have their own opinion about how to prosecute the war. As we know from Francis Marion's approach, he was hitting this, get in, get out. Pickens only had about 300 or so that was fighting under his command. Sumter had better ideas. His concept was to engage the enemy and destroy it. So he sets out, he realizes that this attitude about militia is really not going to work. You need to have a longer trained force. The Continental Army had already been there, and all of those troops were surrendered. So Sumter had bitter ideas. His concept was to engage the enemy and destroy it. So he realizes that this attitude about militia is really not going to work. You need to have a longer trained force. The Continental Army had already been there, and all of those troops were surrendered. So Sumter creates what's called an organization of state troops. State troops are going to be given something called Sumter's Law. Sumter's Law says, if you will enlist in my militia unit as state troops and remain for 10 months, if you're a private, you'll be entitled to divvy up the remains of anything they captured. They were going to loot the battlefield, which is taboo. And war conventions. Everybody else, Washington, Reed, everybody else was against what he was doing. But there was nobody to stop him. So, in addition, all the privates were promised uniforms, horses, everything that I could define except for the only thing that was exempt from the looting that would go on the battlefield was military stores. If you captured an ammo supply dump, that wasn't divvied up. That stayed with the military. As a result of this, Sumter was able to engage the enemy with about 1,000 troops, a number of battles. He does a remarkable job in his combat situations. He wins engagements at a place called Hanging Rock, Blackstock's Stocks Farm, Fishdown Ford. And on all of these, his numbers proved to be true as to what military we would look for as a numerical advantage in the time of the combat. And he's able to do this because of the number of troops that he has built up. He also loses at Rocky Mountain Fishing Creek. And in the Battle of Blackstock that he won, he's severely wounded to the extent that his death was reported among the British authorities for a couple of weeks before it was clearly known that he would not die and would be recovered. But he was out of commission for several weeks of his result of the loss there. If Sumter had been willing to cooperate with Nathaniel Greene when Greene came over, came down and took over the command, so we would probably have been at war sooner, because those 1,000 men, wherever we were fighting, would have been a huge advantage for the Patriots. But Sumter's disdain for chain of command prevented him from agreeing to cooperate with anybody.
Even though he was a fierce fighter, this was a severe limitation from the standpoint of military leaders and historians.
At the end of the war, he serves immediately in the local assemblies. He's in trouble because of Sumter's law that is not acceptable by the general population.
It will take 12 years for all of his promises or the state was willing to provide forgiveness for the steps that he took.
12 years. But he's still very popular and very wealthy.
And as a result of his popularity, he's elected to serve in the House of Representatives. He serves for about 10 years in Congress. And then he moves into the Senate. He does 2 6-year terms in the United States Senate.
He has a distinction of one thing that nobody else in the Revolutionary War Army generals can attest to.
He dies in 1832, 45 days short of being 98 years old.
Wow.
He is the last living
general officer of the militia in the American Revolution. He outlived John Stark, who was the last living Continental general, by 2 years. This distinction comes with a footnote, because most of us, I think, could remember that Lafayette was made a United States citizen. Lafayette did outlive Sumter by 2 years, but he was only like 79 or so when he died.
Dying at age 97 sets the record for all the general officers serving in the United States armies. Obviously, several things made for him. The counties in 5 states and Sumter County in Georgia.
There's Jimmy Carter's country, Plains, Georgia, in Sumter County. Outside of that,
you wouldn't know where Sumter County is. I hope you've appreciated this bridge tour of American Revolutionary War hero Thomas Sumter, very American, Virginia, but he's made his name and fortune in South Carolina. Thank you very much.